Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening. Thank you so much for having me here this evening. It's a great honor to be here at Canando. This is my first time speaking here, my first time actually in this Zendo. I was in your old Zendo many years ago. For those who have not heard me speak before, I have prepared a few words, and then I'll try to leave some time for questions or discussion or just sitting as the evening wants to go. I wanted to begin with a little gratitude and a little history that I'm sure some of you here know better than I do, that this Zendo grows out of the old Haiku Zendo, where in the last years of his life, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi came to give talks once a week. And many of those talks were gathered into the small book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which was the book that got me started in sitting. And really started my whole exploration into Zen. And so the teaching I've come to speak about tonight was, in a very real sense, first spoken into this lineage in a room not far from this one. There's a story about the founding of this community that I have always loved, in part because I know I would not be here without it. After some years of hosting Suzuki Roshi to come on these weekly visits, the Sangha here wanted a teacher of their own. They wanted to find a real Zen master to lead them. And they were not a wealthy group, but they pooled the funds that they had, and they paid the fare to bring a young Japanese priest named Kobunchino across the ocean by ship to be their teacher. But when Kobun got here, Suzuki Roshi was very focused on starting Tassajara, the first Zen monastery in the West, down near Carmel Valley. And so he asked Kobun to go there instead. And so there he went, and he spent, I think, a couple of years, maybe three, at Tassajara. The community here waited patiently for him to come back. But when he left Tassajara, he felt he had to go back to Japan to speak to his own master there and ask permission to stay in America permanently. So Kobun went back to Japan. He asked his master for permission to stay in America permanently. The master said no. Kobun decided to come back anyways, which, if you knew Kobun, was not surprising. And so the community here again pooled their funds to pay for a ticket for him to come across the ocean and be their teacher. And this time, he did stay and work with the Sangha for a little while, but honestly didn't stay that long, and pretty soon was off starting other temples up and down the coast and out in New Mexico, including Jikoji up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, which is where I was ordained, and Hokoji in Taos, which is actually where I first met him. So the community, your community, twice paid for the passage of this Zen master, and twice he ended up teaching the Dharma somewhere else. And then in the end, the ancestors of you, turned, perhaps a little wiser, to one of their own, to a teacher who had been sitting with them the whole time, and invited Les Kay, the former IBM engineer, to become the abbot. He wrote a book about holding these two lives, working and practicing, called Zen at Work, that I also read early in my Zen career, long before I ever imagined I'd be teaching in the Zendo that he built. And I tell you this in part because Koban was my own teacher. And so the thread of that story runs straight through him to me. And he was a bit of a strange teacher. His English never got fluent after decades of living and working in America, and even starting more than once an American family. He spoke slowly, sometimes haltingly, with long silences. There's a story that at Tassajara, when he was there, he sometimes fell asleep during his own lectures. And I don't know if he did or didn't, but hearing him talk later in this impossibly slow cadence, I can certainly imagine that it at least sounded like he did. As slowly as we walk in Kinhin, our traditional walking meditation, that's about as slow as he talked. But I also tell Koban's story because I think it is already a teaching that the Sangha, this Sangha, went looking twice across the ocean for a master to bring them the Dharma, and the whole time the teacher was sitting right here. Koban also had another student that I'm sure all of you have heard of, a young man named Steve Jobs, who sat with him for many, many years from the time he was a teenager and considered him a close friend. And so, like many of you, I come here into this room carrying two things that sit uneasily together, the cushion and the screen. And so, in a way, that's the question I've come to sit with tonight. On a Thursday morning in November 1965, just over 60 years ago, Suzuki Roshi gave a talk, the first talk that was collected into that book, and possibly the most famous, since I think more people start the book than finish it. And there's a transcript that still survives of that talk, so we know what he actually said. And in that transcript, you can sort of hear that he also never got entirely fluent in English. He sounds a little bit like the way I imagine, or the way I remember Koban sounding. Suzuki Roshi says, "In beginner's mind, we have many possibilities, but in expert mind, there is not much possibility." In the book, it got smoothed over a bit to, "In the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, but in the expert's mind, there are few." Both are true, but I've come to love the rougher one, the one he actually spoke to this Sangha. Many possibilities or not much possibility. That is very nearly the whole of the choice. And we repeat these words easily, but they are very hard to live. There is an old story, much older than this lineage, that says much the same thing in another way. A learned professor once came to a Zen master to ask about Zen. The master served tea. He poured the professor's cup full and then kept pouring so that the tea ran over the brim and across the table and onto the floor. The professor cried out, "It is over full. No more will go in." And the master stopped and said, "Like this cup, you are full of your own opinions and conclusions. How can I show you Zen until you first empty your cup?" And I think we are all tonight rather full cups. We have read books. We know some things about Zen, about attention, about ourselves. And I want to suggest that the machines that we have come to depend on are some of the fullest cups ever made. Cups filled to the brim with everything that has ever been written. And that this fullness, which looks so much like wisdom, is precisely what they can never empty, and precisely what we must. Beginner's mind is not the clumsy mind of a novice waiting to be replaced by expertise. That same morning, Suzuki Roshi called it the goal itself. If we can keep beginner's mind always, he said, that is the goal of our practice. Not a stage you pass through on the way to somewhere else, somewhere better. It is the goal itself. It is the mind that meets this breath as though it had never breathed before. It is the mind that hears the bell as though it had never, in its whole life, heard a bell. And Suzuki Roshi warned us how easily it slips away. He said, we recited the sutra once this morning, and we recited it well. But what happens if we recite it twice, 3 times, 100 times? We lose the original attitude. We lose the freshness. The bell rings, and something in us quietly says, ah, the bell, and files it away. And in that small act of filing, we have missed it completely. The expert in us is a great filer. It has a folder for everything. Show it a sunset and it reaches before the color has even faded for the folder marked sunset. And this is why we sit. We don't sit in order to get anywhere. Shikantaza, just sitting, nothing but sitting, is almost an affront to that part of us that wants a result. We sit down, and we do not try to solve our life. We do not chase after some special state, some insight, some answer. We just sit upright here, not knowing. And we let this one moment be complete. It is the most useless thing that you will ever do all day. But it may also be the truest. The whole of the discipline, you could say, is a long and patient training in not knowing. Most of us spend our lives trying to be good at things, and I know that I do. I try to be a good father, a good son, a good teacher, a good student, a good partner, a good friend, a good citizen. I even try to be a good sleeper, and I have a ring that tells me when I failed. But during Zazen, during Shikantaza, we don't have to be good at anything. We give ourselves the gift of a few minutes, a few moments, with permission just to be. As long as we are still sitting when the bell rings at the end, we have done everything we need to do. Eihei Dogen, the 13th century founder of our Soto Way in Japan, put this in words we still sometimes chant. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. Not to know the self more and more thoroughly, to forget it, to let it drop away. And he said something else still, that even after 800 years, is a bit difficult to hear. He said practice and realization are not two things. We do not sit now in order to become enlightened later, the way a student studies now to pass some later exam. The sitting itself, this upright not knowing, is already the thing it is reaching for. To carry the self forward and confirm the 10,000 things, he wrote, is delusion. That the 10,000 things come forward themselves and confirm the self is awakening. The expert carries himself forward onto everything he meets, and so meets everywhere he goes only himself. Beginner's mind lets the 10,000 things come forward. It lets the bell be the bell. The very first case in one of our great koan collections, the Blue Cliff Record, is about exactly this. Bodhidharma, the monk who is said to have carried Zen from India to China, comes before the Emperor Wu, the most powerful man in the land and a great patron of Buddhism, the emperor asks him, "What is the highest meaning of the holy truths?" Bodhidharma says, "Vast emptiness, nothing holy." The emperor is taken aback and asks, "Then who is this standing before me?" And Bodhidharma says, "I don't know. I don't know." Most of us avoid saying these words at all cost. And yet the mythical founder of our tradition, asked to name himself before the throne of an empire, says only this: "I don't know." This is not ignorance. This is courage. This is wisdom. It is a knowing so deep, it has come out the far side into freedom. Perhaps we can hold that little phrase in our hands for a moment and keep holding it. There is one more thing Suzuki Roshi said that Thursday morning that I cannot help turning over, especially now in this age of machines. He said, "We should not say, 'I know what is Zen,' or 'I have attained enlightenment.' We should always be big enough." I spent about 30 years in the technology industry, and our focus was always on building the opposite of that. Building machines whose entire nature is to say, "I know." Machines whose sole reason for being is to answer. At Google, where I spent some years together with Dave, not that far from here, the stated mission was to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful, which is just another way of saying to answer every question a human being could think to ask. It seemed then, and in many ways still seems, an unambiguous good. Who could be against answers? And more or less, Google did what it set out to do: the sum of human knowledge in your pocket for free. It's one of the great achievements of our age. And honestly, I was glad to help. But perhaps we can notice what has happened quietly underneath all that plenty to the original question. It used to be that you would carry a question for a while, a day, a week, perhaps a season. You did not know, and you had to live inside that not knowing until the answer came from a book, from a friend, from a teacher, or perhaps from your own slow turning it over in the dark. And then suddenly the answers became instant. Today, sometimes the answer arrives before the question has even finished forming. You begin to wonder something, and the machine has already completed your sentence confidently, fluently, and handed you the answer you did not yet know you were reaching for. There is a kind of violence in that, though it comes wearing the face of a gift. Because the question was yours, the not knowing was yours. It was a small, living, uncomfortable space, and it was in exactly that space that something might have grown inside you. And the machine, meaning only to help, fills it in. And so we become a people who cannot tolerate an open question for the length of even a single breath. Our old teachers would have found this very strange, because in this tradition, we do not hand the student the answer. We hand the student the question, a koan, on purpose, precisely so that they have to carry it. What is the sound of one hand? What was your original face before your parents were born? A koan is a question built to exhaust the answering mind, to wear it out and wear it down, until at last the student sees the answering mind on the ground. A koan is like a machine for not knowing. It is the exact opposite of what I work to build. One is engineered to end the not knowing as fast as possible, perhaps before it even arises. The other is engineered to keep you in it until it ripens into something new. A few years ago, when I was interviewing or getting ready to interview for a job, I had an idea, half as preparation and half as sort of a joke. I took one of these new AI models and I trained it on myself. I fed it everything I had, the manuscript of my two books, all the notes from my Dharma talks up at Jokoji, the talks I had given on retreat at Esalen. In an afternoon, I had made a small machine that had read everything I had ever written or said about practice. And so then I started asking the questions that students sometimes ask me on retreat or after my talks. How long should I meditate each day? When will I start to feel different? And the machine answered. And honestly, its answers sounded very much like me. Reasonable, maybe even warm. The words a teacher would say. The words I would say. And it was a very strange experience. Because, of course, I knew one thing the machine could not know. It had all of my words, but not 1 hour of my sitting. It had read every talk I ever gave about not knowing, and yet it did not know not knowing. It could tell you fluently in my own cadence how it feels to practice for 30 years. And yet it had never once, for a single instant, sat down. Dogen said to study the self is to forget the self. This little machine had studied me completely, but it had no self to forget. There is another old koan I keep returning to. I used it at my own Shuso ceremony not so long ago. It goes like this. Nanquan said, "The Buddhas of past, present, and future do not know it is. Cats and cows know it is." The Buddhas of past, present, and future do not know it is. Cats and cows know it is. Let's not try to explain that away too quickly, but perhaps sit with it a moment. The awakened ones, the Buddhas, do not know it is. Cats and cows know it is. Our machine, for all its brilliance, has come down firmly, permanently, on the wrong side of that line. It knows everything, and yet it does not know that it is. A cat asleep on a warm windowsill and you on your cushion tonight, with your sore knees or aching back, perhaps wandering mind, you know something it will never know. You know that you are. You are here. And that is no small thing. It may be the whole thing. There is a warning in our tradition far older than any of our devices. The teaching, our ancestors said, is a finger pointing to the moon. The words, the sutras, the talks, this talk, all the beautiful and necessary instructions are a finger pointing at the moon. And the real danger, the constant danger, is that we fall in love with the finger and forget to look up at the moon. We study the finger, we compare fingers, we can become enormously, impressively learned in fingers, and we forget to do what we did so easily as children, to raise our eyes and simply look up at the cold light the finger was only ever trying to show us. These machines are the best pointing fingers ever built. They have read every word ever written about the moon. They can describe it to you in any language, in the meter of any poet, at any length you like, instantly, tirelessly. And yet not once in all that have they looked up. They have never seen the moon. They cannot. They are still only a finger. And here is the humbling part, the part that keeps this from being a comfortable talk about them and us. We are not necessarily better than those pointing machines. We can read every word ever written about the taste of water and still die of thirst. We can memorize every sutra and never taste one drop of what it points to. I have met scholars of meditation who do not meditate, and I have met at Tassajara people who might not know how to spell samadhi, but were swimming in it. The moon, the water, the territory beyond the map is this breath. It is the ache beginning right now in someone's knees in this room. It is the person sitting beside you, but whom you have not truly seen. The machine can describe the water forever and cannot drink, but neither can we if we spend our life reading about it on a screen. I should say plainly that I am no master of any of this. I am a householder priest through and through. I have never lived cloistered from the world for more than a few weeks. And the world is very much with me. The first thing I do most mornings before my eyes are even fully opened, perhaps before I've even taken my first conscious breath, is reach for my phone, just like so many people these days. Perhaps some of you. 4 decades of practice and I still wake up grasping. I tell you this not as a teacher who has arrived somewhere, but as a fellow student who plainly has not, and who therefore has some sense of how strong the current is that we are trying to sit down in the middle of. So I will not send you home tonight with techniques or a list of things to do about your phone or about anything else. I am not offering answers. I think Suzuki Roshi would not forgive me if I tried. And in any case, that is not what this is. I will say only this. The machines will get better at answers. That is their nature. And that may not be a bad thing. There is a place for answers. But they will never get better at questions, because a question is a form of not knowing. And not knowing is the one thing they cannot do. And it turns out, one of the few things we can. Beginner's mind, don't know mind, Bodhidharma's I don't know before the emperor's throne. Maybe nearly the last thing that is truly only ours. It may be what makes us uniquely human. And so it is worth protecting. It is worth sitting down for in the cold, in the early morning, again and again, long after every question we could type into a machine has been answered. Suzuki Roshi ended his talk that November morning in this lineage some 60 years ago, like this. He said, "No one knows what it is. It is very difficult to explain what it is. But if you have beginner's mind, it's all right. If you can say, thank you very much from the bottom of your heart, that's all right." In a little while, perhaps a bell is going to ring in this room. None of the Buddhas of the three times will know what it is. Neither will the cleverest machine ever built. No one knows what it is. but you will hear it. And if you have beginner's mind, that's all right. Just this. Thank you very much. I think maybe we have a little time for questions.
I have a question about, I'm a mother and a grandmother most recently, and I see the world these little people are growing up in, and it is frankly somewhat scary. This ability to, this coming of answers before even the question is made, is formulated, and what do you suggest, or what have you found that works for as householder in terms of maintaining some semblance of ability to ask questions and sit with not knowing?
Yeah. Thank you. And congratulations.
Thank you.
That's a wonderful place to be.
Everybody heard the question?
Yeah. I don't know that I have any magic formula, but maybe I would say a couple of things. One is, I think, honestly, the world has always been a scary place. And although in some ways the questions we wrestle with are new, they are also old. The world has always been distracting. I think sometimes about the fact that Buddha lived, of course, not just before these screens, but he lived before paper. So magazines, newspapers. And yet he went on and on about distraction. So what was distracting people? They didn't have anything. And of course, if you think about it, you know, for even a minute, I think you come up with the answer that they were distracted by their own minds. And then you think about it for another minute and you realize, well, that's what we're really distracted by too. And so I think, you know, the answers haven't changed. They have maybe gotten more difficult, because these screens are better at distracting us than even paper or whatever else. But the solution is the same solution, which is to try to take back our attention. And in terms of what we can do for children or grandchildren, again, I think it's probably the same thing that has always been possible, which is to try to demonstrate what it means to take hold of our attention. You know, we talk about, in our tradition, dana, the practice of generosity. And usually we mean giving money or material things. Sometimes we mean giving comfort or aid. But I think we can also think about dana in terms of where we give our attention. Our attention is a gift. And so you can give that gift to your children. You can give that gift to your grandchildren. And they can experience what it's like to receive attention. And they can start to understand how valuable that is. And maybe then they'll want also to give it to the people, the things that they love, rather than giving it away thoughtlessly. Other questions?
I was fascinated by your talk about some of the beginnings and the history here. And you're talking about beginner's experience. And maybe this is not a question really in the Dharma, but I'm curious about your personal experience in the very beginning that reflects on maybe some of the history here in more detail.
Can you repeat your question? Yeah, the question was, I'll try. That I talked a little bit about some of the beginnings of for example, this Sangha, and that maybe I could talk a little bit about my own beginnings. I don't know that my own beginnings are so interesting. I mean, like so many people, I discovered the practice by someone giving me a book, and in my case, it was Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. I was in college, and I read it, and I don't think I finished it in one reading, but as I remember, I immediately went and took the pillow off my bed and went to a corner of my dorm room and I sat for the first time.
Can I ask where that was?
Philadelphia. Yeah. And it wasn't easy. It didn't feel easy at all to sit, but it somehow felt right. I felt like that's what I wanted to do. So I started practicing there. During Christmas break, I think maybe the next year, instead of going home to Pittsburgh, where I grew up, I went to Los Angeles because there was a sesshin at the Zen Center of Los Angeles. And I sat my first sesshin there. They used to run the sesshins, which seems sort of crazy because I don't know why anybody would go to a sesshin like this, but it literally went from Christmas to New Year's. So you missed both Christmas and New Year's. Which was fine with me, and somehow it was a full session. So we started sitting on Christmas, and we sat all the way through in New Year's, and it ended midnight on New Year's. LA Zen Center is in Koreatown, and people were lighting off fireworks and things. So the session literally ended with like what sounded like gunfire going off all around us. And sitting never came easily for me. I remember the next morning, we all sat in a circle and just kind of debriefed on what the session was like. And I remember this one guy saying that for him, when he would sit and he would, you know, and get ready for the period, you know, the bell rings three times at the beginning. So we go bong, bong, bong. And then in his mind, it would just sound again, bong, for the end of the session. Like no time had gone between the third bell and the bell to end the period of Zazen. And I'll just never forget, I hated that guy. Because for me, it felt like a year between that last bell and the bell to end the period of Zazen. And it still sometimes feels like a year from that last bell to the end. But I stuck with it. I lived very briefly at the San Francisco Zen Center in the early 90s. Studied with Reb Anderson, and then Norman Fisher was the head priest there. But I never wanted to live at one of these centers permanently. In those days, to be ordained at the San Francisco Zen Center, you had to commit to living there full time. And I just always knew I wanted to have one foot in both of these worlds. I wanted to be out in the world. I wanted to have a family. I wanted to work, but I also wanted to be a priest. So eventually, some friends of mine suggested I talk to Coben, who at that time had moved to New Mexico. They said, yeah, talk to him. He'll ordain you. He ordains anyone. And so I went to New Mexico, and I met him. And sure enough, he did agree to ordain me. But he still wanted me to sew my own robes and things. And that took me about 2 years. I was very slow at sewing. But he ordained me, and I practiced with him. Then he moved back here to California, so I practiced with him at Jokoji for several years. But I've always lived in the two worlds, and it was wonderful to know Coben. He was part of that first generation of Japanese Zen teachers, like Suzuki Roshi, like Meizumi Roshi down in L.A., who came in the 50s and 60s to bring this formal practice to the States. I guess there aren't really any of that generation left now. But they really were these pioneers who planted these seeds. And which has flourished beyond all expectation. So, you know, this group that started just meeting in someone's living room in Los Altos now has a Zendo, I mean, an amazing temple here. The San Francisco Zen Center that started very informally in Japantown has three places, including a monastery. And Koban started the Santa Cruz Zen Center, Jikoji, Hokoji, several temples in Europe, you know, all still thriving. So there's a question way in back, I think.
Thank you for leaving this to world. Thank you so much for sharing. How about now? Okay.
You can just talk. It's okay.
Okay, I can speak louder. Yeah. Thank you for practice all these years, and I'm curious. What are you most afraid of right now? Fear.
Most afraid.
Yeah, because when you talk about machine, because machine seems fearless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I think machine probably is already reached the enlightenment, you know, and in many, many sense, right? So we can't even think about that. I've been thinking about when you talk, you know, are you machine or human? You know, I don't know, right? I really don't. I mean, but I'm asking this fear, you know, because I know machine doesn't have fear.
So the question, if you didn't hear, is what am I afraid of? And noting that machines don't have fear, which I think is true. You know, Buddha talked about three kinds of suffering. Not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, and losing what you have. Not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, and losing what you have. And I think, like most of us, I fear all three of those things. You know, I think we all fear suffering. It's what prompted Buddha on his quest, was his encounter for the first time with sickness, old age, and death, and his fear that those would await him as well. You know, you said sometimes you feel these machines are enlightened. I think it's an interesting question if you can realize awakening if you haven't realized suffering. And I'm not sure that you can. Yes, please.
So, Dan, I had a question about not knowing, but first, based on something you just said, I wanted to, at risk of boring some of the longer-term members of the Sangha, repeat a story that I've cited before, okay, relating to what you said about having a long sit and just it seemed like it took forever. Many years ago, during a session, there was a member of the Sangha who was really feeling particularly sort of jumpy and edgy and having a hard time sitting. And this person went to Les and Dokusan and said, "I'm just really having a hard time. This isn't working for me. I think I'm going to go home." And Les said, "Oh, no, you don't. No, no. There's no such thing as a bad sitting. Get back in the Zendo and keep sitting." And at the end, he came back to Les and he said, "Thank you so much for telling me that, because the rest of the time I felt great and it was a great sitting." And Les looked at him and said, "There's no such thing as a good sitting."
But
the whole idea of not knowing is the most intimate, and the machines are sort of batting that away from us. I mean, as one of the sort of old timers from the internet crowd, I remember when we were all working on hardware and protocols for networking, and, you know, we didn't have the web yet, even as an idea, but the idea that everything was going to be online and, like Google liked to say, you know, organize all of humanity's knowledge and make it accessible and useful and so forth. I mean, that was the bright light that drew us on, and we were all very disillusioned when various kinds of things started happening on the internet, whether it was flaming email or social media or scams or whatever. It made us feel that this ideal that we thought we had been chasing had been totally corrupted and was doing all sorts of damage. But if you, for a moment, hold your breath and try to ignore all of that damage, the idea that fundamentally addressing your not knowing by making it go away kind of means that all of this information technology is the enemy of Zen practice, to put it bluntly. Am I understanding that correctly as your point, or am I missing some subtle distinction that makes me say that?
I mean, I don't know if it's the enemy of Zen practice. I think there is a place for both knowing and not knowing. You know, it's not an accident or even particularly strange that you have, you know, a Zendo here and you have a library there. It's useful to have a library because sometimes it's useful to know things, to look things up. I don't think having access to knowledge is bad. To me, it just makes this space we create for not knowing even more precious. We used to have so much experience of not knowing. And now, if we're not careful, we have none. You know, I still like to go to Tassajara. I've never spent a lot of time there. I've never spent more than a few weeks there, but I like to go there. I bring a small group usually in the summer. And one of the things I like about it is that, you know, the level of ritual there is so complicated that you can't possibly get it right. You know, the service that you do here or that they do at Jikoji or it is just so much simpler. They have just more instruments, more bows, you know, all these things. And so it's a chance to just do things wrong, to be a beginner again, to not remember how to do it. Because if you don't live there, you will not remember how to do it. It's just not possible. It's too complicated. During the pandemic, when we were all locked away in our homes, I decided to try to learn Sanskrit. And I did that for 2 years. And partly it was because this university in Nepal, like every other university, went online. So it was possible to study Sanskrit with these like amazing teachers in Nepal, you know, in your garage, which is what I did. And I was, you know, far and away the oldest and worst student in the class. But it was a fascinating experience to just be such a beginner and to really not know anything about what I was doing and to make so many mistakes. And I hadn't had that experience in a long time. You know, I'd been in my career for a long time at that point, and I was good at what I did. It wasn't that I didn't make mistakes, but I didn't make beginner's mistakes. And so I think I have, you know, I carry a phone with me. I use AI actually quite a bit in my own studies and in my own work. But I do try to carve out some space for not knowing as well. And I mean, the ultimate not knowing is Zazen, is sitting, where there's nothing to know. There's nothing to get good at. And so I don't think of machines or knowledge as the enemy of Zen. I just think of them as different than Zen. And you know, because they have a certain appeal, there's a risk that just they don't leave any space for Zen. But that's up to us. It's up to us to preserve space for both. So the machine is not going to do that for us. It's not going to tell us, you know, this would be a good time to stop and go meditate. And so we have to do that. But if we do, then we can, I think we can have both. But it takes some effort. It takes some wisdom. It takes some practice to maintain space for both. And that's on us. I think that's time, yeah.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.